heard before. One of them is what we call initial value problems. And what we would have would, for instance, be something where x prime here was given as some function of t and x here. And then perhaps we would be given the value that the function would have in our initial point, hence the name initial value problem. And then we want to solve this for x of t, right? So you can, of course, imagine a number of problems. This is the very simplest one, where we look at a case where I have a first-order equation, and I just have one of them, and I want to figure out what's going on at a later time. I'm not going to be talking about that today. We're going to come back to that a little later. So we're going to do things a little bit out of order, because what I want to tell you about today is boundary value problems. And in particularly, of course, how we want to solve the Schrodinger equation, right? So we may have some equation where it would have a2 of x here, and then the second derivative of y here, dx squared, and then plus a1 of x, and then dy dx here, and then plus a 0x here times y maybe, and this could then be our equation, and then we have to specify not only the function in one point, but usually what we do is that we specify the function at the two boundaries. So if we're looking for a solution to this equation on an interval here, then we would also specify the solution over on the other end of the interval. And this is something quite different. Usually when I think about this, I think about the vibrating string. So if you put a string and suspend it between A and B, then and you want to figure out how that string could move, this is something that's quite different from, for instance, launching a ball with a given speed and then figuring out where that ball is going to go, right? So that's the two kinds of problems that we'll be looking at. And of course, when we look at boundary value problems, there are many different variations on them. I could specify the value of the solution at A and maybe the derivative over at B. Maybe I would do the derivative here in A and the value the function has over in B, or whatever you like. It's not going to change dramatically the underlying methods. So what we'll look at today is this one. So we're going to be talking about this today. And this we'll do later, right? So actually, let me, perhaps I should start over here, because we're gonna look at a very simple problem that you've seen many times before. So what we want to do, and what you will be doing for the homework, is that we'll solve Schrodinger's equation in a potential well, right? But if you've done this, and I assume you've done that in several other classes, then your potential wells have probably been fairly nicely behaved. So what we could add here is that for our purposes of solving this numerically, then we can just do it for any potential well.
Yes.
You can of course generalize this to two dimensions. So yeah, let's just say here that it's 1D.
Time dependent or independent?
No, it's just going to be time dependent. No, time independent, right? So we're looking for bound states in these wells here. So the underlying equation is we have. Is this one, right? And we're looking for bound states. Now, you already know from quantum mechanics that if I have a finite potential well, there might also be states that would be interesting to look at that would not really be bound states. And we're just, for the moment, going to neglect that, right? So E here, if this is a solution that we're looking for, then typically we would call that an eigenvalue, right? So the setting would be something like this. I would have my potential well, and it would be sitting here. And it's a finite potential well. And whenever we do this in quantum mechanics, then this region over here is called 1. And this here is called 2. And this here is called 3. Right? So if we first look here in region 1 and and then I said that we were going to be looking here at bound states. So that means that we might be considering an energy that is here. Right? So this here might be our energy. And then I'm looking at this region here. Then, of course, I can move my equation here around. So I'm just looking at a standard second order equation. Okay, so if I do this, then over on the other side here, I'm going to have V minus E here. And that's going to be equal to that, right? So if I'm here, then I would say that the potential is above the energy. And actually, V minus E here, that's equal to a constant. So we would have something of this type. And so my first question to all of you, and I'm certain you know the answer to this question, is, what are the solutions to Schrödinger's equation in region 1 and 3? And that's, of course, wrong. It's not wrong. It's half the answer. So what?
Either positive or negative. Real part.
Well, they're all exponentials.
You're right. Like they're all parts.
No, so. Well, so let me get to my point.
Positive or zero real part.
Let me get to my point that this equation here, right, it is just a second order differential equation. And we know that there is sort of. So lambda squared here is bigger than zero, right? So you all know and love the solution e to the minus lambda x. But There is unfortunately also the other solution, which is e to the lambda x, right? So, and that's a perfectly good solution. It didn't do us any harm. It didn't do anything. And yet we treat it very badly. That is, we always throw it out, right? So this is going to create a little problem for us, as we'll see shortly, because so we need to somehow tell the computer that we don't want e to the plus lambda x as a solution in region three. And again, I want to stress that there's nothing wrong with that solution. It is a solution to our second order differential equation. So why do we throw it away?
Not normalizable.
Yeah, it's not normalizable, but that doesn't. So we could also say that maybe it doesn't satisfy our boundary conditions, because if we require that it's normalizable, that sort of amounts to saying that the function has to go to zero at infinity, right? But somehow we have to build that in. Okay, so we have to keep this in mind, that in the regions here, 1 and 3, then, well, we know that we're going to have exponentially decaying and exponentially increasing solutions. Does this remind you of something that you did for something somewhere? Well, okay. Well, there was also Bessel's equation. There was also a second order equation that also had two solutions, right? And maybe for the homework, we wondered what happened to the other one. So it's again an example that we have been so, let's say, brainwashed, because we do physics, that we impose a lot of constraints on the solutions, and we throw away, just with a sleight of the hand, a lot of solutions, because they're sort of not physical. But mathematically, they're still solutions. And they're going to play some important role here. So clearly, we need now to develop some scheme for solving this equation. So what we're going to try to develop here is starting from somewhere where we could approximate the solution. So our strategy here, it's going to be to maybe say that psi here, when x here is equal to some constant that we say equal to minus c. So minus c would be sitting out here. We say that, okay, well, I know about this, and maybe I should be careful. But if I go out here, then I could say that, well, for all practical purposes, the solution I'm looking for, I can say that it's equal to zero there, right? And then what we need to do is then we integrate towards the right. Okay, so that sounds like a reasonable strategy to most of you. Well, what I mean by integrate is specifically, I need some scheme to try to get psi in x equal to minus c, and then plus a little step. Yeah. Probably we want to take that step to be small. So that's our next. So if we decide that, okay, this here sounds like a reasonable strategy, I go out here in the region where I know that the function should, the solution I'm looking for should be exponentially decreasing, then, well, okay, I go far enough away that I can set it equal to zero. And then I need to develop a scheme for taking one step to the right. Yes. Yes, but it doesn't, well, as you'll see here, the form of this, well, I can just take it, could be anything.
Right, if you had, like, stuff going on, like, past your...
Yes, obviously, obviously. Actually, you could easily cook up schemes here where you could have, sort of, two wells or whatnot. But you would, and you can see that, well, we'll talk about that. but for the moment, let's just try to do the simplest thing. And believe me, it's going to be headaches enough for all of you. We're just thinking about this problem, a finite 1D potential well. And then we could imagine that somehow maybe it wasn't a box, but any kind of function. Okay, so I need to develop a scheme for taking one step to the right. And there are many ways of doing this, I'm not going to impose any kind of judgment on you, but I want to talk about what's called Numerov's method. And that's just because it's a nice illustration of the way that you develop these algorithms for taking a step. The other point is that I can do it very briefly. It's not difficult to tell you what Numerov's method is. And lastly, it's valid here for second order equations with no first derivative. Right, and if we go over and check on this side here, then lo and behold, in the Schrodinger equation that we wrote down there, there's no first derivative. And we'll see why that becomes important. So, let's try to rewrite the equation that we want to solve here. So I have something of this form here. By the way, before I, okay, let me just, that's equal to zero. Even though I've been writing on the blackboard for many years, my handwriting tends to get a little bit sloppy. So I just want to point out that this is nicely described in Pang on pages 104, even though his way of deriving Numerov's method, I think, is a little bit more obscure than what I'll tell you about, right? So this is the equation that we want to solve here. And what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to write it like this. So I have some function that I'm going to call k squared of x here. That's equal to 0. Okay, and this equation here, we're going to call that 1. So I just want to repeat part of what we did yesterday. So I can look at the Taylor expansions around any given point, and that's usually how we arrive at these finite different methods. So just let's just repeat a bit of what we did yesterday, because I need a piece in there that you might not remember. So I would have something like this, and then plus h3 over 3 factorial psi 3, and then h4 over 4 factorial psi 4, right? And again, if I take a step in the other direction, I can do the same Taylor expansion, and if we do this, you can see that we will, plus h4 over 4 factorial psi 4. So we just want to combine these for the moment. And then we arrive at the formula for the second derivative that we had yesterday. So if I look at this, then I could say that, psi of x plus h here, plus psi of x minus h, and then minus 2 psi of x here. And then I need to divide by h squared here. Well, you can see when I add these two, then I get my 2 psi of x here. All these terms will cancel, but this one won't cancel, right? So if I do it like that, then I'm actually stuck with minus 8 squared over 12, right? Yes, and the fourth derivative. And then I would have some higher order terms here, which would start with h4. So far, I just repeated. What we did before. So let's try to get to the meat of it, and let's see how we can do a step here. So there is a trick, and that's what Numerov came up with. If you look at this equation, then you can see that there's this error term, minus 8 squared over 12. And we need a little trick that could cancel that. So the trick here is apply 1 plus 1 over 12, and then the second derivative. So you apply this operator to this equation, right? If we do that, then I sort of, if you like, rewrite our starting version of Schrodinger equation, but it's still a second order differential equation that is equal to 0. So let's see how that would work, right? So if I do it, well, what do I get here? Well, I would get the second derivative here. Oh, sorry, there's an 8 squared here I missed. Right? And then I would get plus 8 squared over 12, and then the fourth derivative. That would be this term just applied to the first, second order derivative of psi here. And then we need to also apply it to the second one here. So I'm just going to get chi squared here. I want to lump all this together and call that chi or k squared, and then write it like this. That makes more sense, right? So we want to get rid of these 2m over h bar squared. So if I do this, then I just get my chi or k squared of x here, psi. And then I get another less interesting term here, which is h squared over 12. And then the second derivative here applied to k squared multiplied by psi. And this here is equal to 0. So now what we're going to do here is I'm going to look down at my formula just below it. Then I can if I call this equation here, if I call that 2, then I can just substitute that result in, and then you can probably guess that I came up with this idea here precisely because I wanted to cancel that term, right? So if I substitute in 2 here, then I get something like this, minus 2 psi of x over 8 squared, right? Then this term here is canceled by that. So maybe we want to remember that there was some error now, which in this case went up to h4. And then I have my remaining terms, psi here, k squared psi, and then plus this one over 12. And this is equal to 0. Okay, so I cooked up this little trick here. And you can see that all we need to do now is to take so that's, you know, that was the only trick here is to take that operator and apply it to our starting equation. So then we have this, and we're almost done. So all we need to do is that I just need to rewrite it so that I would have some psi x plus h here. And it would depend on something with psi of x here, and then maybe something else with psi of x minus h, right? So you all agree that if I can reach this point here, which doesn't seem too hard because I'm almost there due to the fact that I managed to rewrite the second derivative, then I would have a working scheme, right? Except for some of you might be asking, well, you know, I said that I took the point here at minus c and I set it equal to 0. And here I'm sort of hinting at the fact that I actually need to start my integration towards positive x with two values. So we're going to have to look at that a little bit later. But for the moment, let's not worry about that. Let's just assume that I can manipulate this around. This is just algebra now, right? The other thing is that you can see that if in our starting equation for the Schrodinger equation here, if there had been a first-order derivative here, then it wouldn't have worked because I would have gotten weird terms here, right? There would have been a third derivative that would have cropped in. So this little trick here, it only works. So this here works because there's no first derivative. Right. Okay, so I'm just going to do some tedious algebra because we need to approximate, and in particularly what we need to approximate is that term there, right? So I want to look at the second derivative of k squared of psi here, and with respect to x. So what we're just going to do is that we're going to use the formula that we looked at and I've just written there before, right? So it's going to be k squared here in x plus h, psi in x plus h, then plus k squared in x minus h, psi in x minus h, and then minus 2 k squared of x, psi of x. And this we need to divide by h squared. And then actually here, then there's a term that will start with some oh squared. So we could be worried about the oh squared here, but fortunately we go over and say, oh, we breathe a sigh of relief because that contribution to my final equation here, I'm going to be multiplying it with h squared. So you can see that the error here is going to go up to fourth order, which matches this one. So for the moment, we're fine. So what we're going to do is that I'm just going to take this result here and then substitute it in here, right? So we substitute into 3 here, if that's our equation 3 here, after multiplying by h squared, right? So let me see if I can actually do this. So I would so what I mean by this is I'm going to multiply the whole equation here by h squared, right? So I'm going to get psi of x plus h here, then plus psi of x minus h, and then minus 2 psi of x. And then I'm going to get plus h squared here. K squared of x psi, right? And then I'm going to get plus h squared over 12, and then whatever we had there, which was this psi of x plus h, and then plus k squared of x minus h psi of x minus h, and then minus 2 k squared of x in psi of x. No? Yes, yes, but I need to cancel out that one as well. So I believe this is right. So we're done. I just need to isolate, just as we were writing here, isolate. So I have psi of x plus h. So we look at where psi of x plus h occur. Well, it occurs here, and it occurs there. So probably I get something here, which is 1 over 1 plus 8 squared over 12 k squared of x plus h. Right? And then I need to multiply that with something. So if I took these two terms, that and that, and then put everything over on the other side, I would be starting with perhaps this term, right? And then I can put this one over there as well. And maybe we also want to put this one, k squared psi of x there. And then we just need whatever is left here, and that would be these two terms. So I would get minus 8 squared over 12, and then k squared of x minus h, psi of x minus h, and then I get plus 2h squared over 12, k squared of x, psi of x, and then I end it, right? We're done now because I just want to rewrite this once again. So the final form of this that I sort of hinted was what I was after. I would have my 1 here, and then plus 8 squared over 12, and then k squared of x plus h. And then we need to look here. And then we can see where psi of x occurs. Well, it occurs there, there, and there. And we can just lump that together. So I get something that's 2 and then minus 1 minus 5 over 12 k squared of x psi of x. And then I need the remaining terms, which is just these two terms, right? So that's very simple. It's just 1 plus 8 squared over 12, and then k squared in x minus h, and then psi of x minus h. They don't look pretty, do they? This is a typical word version of these formulas. So I have basically what I did is that by applying my little trick here, I arrived at a finite difference equation for the second-order differential equation. And that allows me to take one step to the right. Yeah.
Is there supposed to be an h associated with that power of 12?
Probably. We can just look here. So where did it come from? So it would be it's this term here. So you can see I get the first two here. That's this one. And then the remaining terms would be that one and that one. So I think you're right. It should be 5 times h squared. which I don't have in my notes here, but thanks for correcting that. So this was the easy part, right? This is just mathematics. So we want to look at our strategy again now. So we had decided that we take psi here in x minus c, and I set it equal to 0. So first thing you might want to depend on here is, I might want to think about here is, should c depend on E here? What do you think? Why should it?
Because if you have an energy very close to the height of potential.
Precisely, right? The if I start moving the energy up here, so that I get close to the rim of the potential, then it's going to be decaying very slowly. So we can expect that things will be a lot more problematic once I get up in an energy range that's up here. So let's, for the moment, aim at getting the solutions down here. So, okay, I would go up here and say, well, maybe that's what I'm going to call x minus h. But then I would need also a value for one step further on. So what would you think we could do?
Set it to some positive number, and then we have an unnormalized wave function that we'll have to go back and normalize after.
Sounds familiar to some of you.
Did we do this
with Bessel function? Almost, right? You set it equal to 0, and then you took the Bessel function for n minus 1, and you set it equal to something else. And again, but so it's, but yeah, that's also a second order differential equation. But it's, so what we could do here is that we could say, well, if I do in minus c and then plus this, suppose I set it equal to epsilon. And Chris said, well, you know, if we do this, then we have somehow at least modified the overall normalization. But that's okay, because we can fix that by normalizing. So when you do this on the computer, you all know how to do integrals right now, right? And this is much simpler than what you did before, because you just want to integrate the square of the result that you get and make sure that it actually comes out not to be 2 billion, but some finite number, probably 1, right? So we can fix this by normalizing. Did we do something else if I put this equal to epsilon? So we all agree that that would probably fix the normalization, but it will fix something else?
We also throw out a solution
Well, we hope that we did.
Well, because now it's increasing in that region monotonically.
Yeah, yeah, so let's get back to that, but and that's a very sticky point, but did we fix something else by setting the wave function equal to epsilon then? Well, what do you mean by saying it's positive?
Wave function is positive.
Yeah, is that always the case that the wave function is going to be positive?
Making it real.
Yeah, the Schrodinger equation is
invariant. What?
The Schrodinger equation is invariant under sign change, right?
Yes.
So yeah, it's always positive.
No, it's real.
But that wasn't in reality, you know. Like, if you have a solution where it's negative at that place, you can make it positive, right?
Yeah. So, this is very basic. But what I would claim here is if you go in and set this equal to plus epsilon, you have fixed the overall sign. So you could say that, if there's a wave function, I have a solution, then I could multiply it by a constant. It would still be a solution, right? So first of all, this will play tricks with our normalization. But it also, here, we made a choice. Because here, we have fixed the overall sign, because I said that, out here, the wave function is positive, right? I went up. Okay.
Well, we could just say that epsilon is some constant times e to the I theta or something.
Yeah, try telling that to the computer.
Okay. I thought that's why we had complex types.
Yeah. Let's just agree on the fact that if we came in and set it equal to epsilon, then we have made a decision on the overall phase of the wave function, right? Because I've said that it's going to be equal to epsilon at that point, right? So please remember this one. Fix the normalization. So now the problems will occur. Right? So we have our well here, and maybe it looks something like this. And we start out here. And so this would be on point minus C. And then I'm integrating in my little steps here. And then I'm hitting the well. This should be not wobbly. And then I'm maybe starting to oscillate. And then I go over here. What do you think is going to happen?
Now we have two solutions in that region.
Yes. So what will happen if I continue here?
Well, we need to have that there's continuity of the first derivative in order to reject one of the solutions.
But so far, I'm just stepping, right? I take one little step, another little step, another little step. No, I'm not doing anything about that. So what's going to happen once I get over in region 3 here? What?
It's that power that you told it to start. Just cutting out the step.
I claim that to the order that I specified, my stepping is going to give me a solution to the second order differential equation. There's nothing wrong with that. It's always going to be working. But I didn't tell it which one I wanted. So if I'm stepping over here, then you can see that the bad solution, that would be e to the minus x if this here is 0. And as I go in that direction, I'm lucky enough that the bad solution that I don't want, which would be diverging at infinity, so this here would be the bad solution. That's going to be decreasing. And that's good, because the solution that I want, this one, that will be increasing. So we could say, maybe we want to call this the dominant solution. And maybe we want to call this one the decreasing or subdominant solution. But what will happen over here?
Well, yeah. Didn't you say every one of these three boundary value problems, so we should specify something on the right side as well? So can we start and do the same thing backwards from the right?
Precisely.
Right. Hopefully they meet up.
What?
Hopefully they meet up.
Yes. So, well, all I'm trying to tell you is that there's nothing wrong with doing what you're doing, but if you do continue past this point where you get into region three, then the other thing is going to be working for you or working against you, that the solution that we don't want, which is our e to the plus lambda x, that will now be dominant. So if you just crank ahead, you're still going to get a solution in this region to your second order differential equation by this stepping algorithm. But what will likely happen, and you can actually go in and check this, it's just going to suddenly go to infinity. And so to say, that's not an error, right? Because the mathematics is working for you. You're finding a solution to your second order differential equation. It's just not the one you want. Because as you're saying, our boundary conditions are sitting, if you like, out here at minus infinity and plus infinity. And we're not building that in, right? So the only way, or the most obvious way to get around this is we have to integrate also from right to left. Okay, so I can do precisely what I did here. I start out now in the other region. So I would start out here. I would start at psi of x equal to plus c, for instance, and I would set that equal to 0, and then I need the wave function in c minus h, and I would probably set that equal to epsilon. So what we're going to call this solution here is, I think I call it phi L, because I'm integrating from the left to the right. And then over here, I call this solution the integration from the right. And then precisely as you were saying, we hope that they meet somewhere and actually agree on the value and the slope at that point. Right? And the name of the game is that that will only occur for specific values of the energy. Right? It's just think about vibrating string. If I'm trying to send in a wave from one end and then a wave from the other end, then it's only for sort of magic solutions that it'll actually match up, right? So we're going to have to do some matching. And what I claim is that we're forced to do this because we're building in the boundary conditions that way. But there's another point here. If I do this, and I sit here, I take the wave function over here, and I set it equal to epsilon. Was that totally innocent?
No.
No.
What? Now we've set not just the global phase, but the relative phase between the two extremes.
Yes. Or in other words, I fixed the phase once again, right? So I fixed the phase over here, and I fixed the phase over there.
So when we
and then you sort of go, uh-oh, maybe, even though all I did, I just went in and I said a little number equal to plus something, right? Maybe those two choices are not consistent, right? And particularly if we look at a wave function, which would be odd. So if I put in so I think the potential that you'll be looking at is nicely behaved in the sense that it's symmetrical around x equal to 0. So I could imagine that I would have an actual solution which would do something like this. Then when I'm integrating over here, then I could be making the phase choice where my solution would be like this. And then when I'm integrating from the other side, I could make a positive wave function over here. So it would be integrating up like that. And then you would be actually staring at a perfectly valid solution. But because you get confused about your phase choices, then the derivative would be off by a truckload, right? Because you've just got the sign wrong, right? And they, well, maybe they would actually both go through zero here, but nothing would work. And it's a very innocent little problem, because you just went in and didn't realize that you fixed the overall phase twice. So how do you think we're going to solve it? Somebody see an easy way to solve this?
Basically requires that the first derivatives match up there, and you carry with you not just an epsilon, but a phase constant, and then
Yeah. So what we want to do is that we want to do a consistent phase choice. So I want to call my two solutions phi L and phi R here. So what we do is that we integrate phi L here from minus C up to a point that I call XM, which will be the matching point, and then one step beyond it. And then I integrate phi r here from plus c, and if you like, we can say down to xm minus h. Okay, is that clear? So we integrate from either side, and then we have chosen a point, and I haven't told you. Obviously, you could think that you could take any point. But it's gonna be not so innocent what you choose for that point.
We can't choose any point, or else we'd wind up with the same problem we had here. And if we chose a point in region 3 to be the matching point, we'd still have a dominant.
Yes, so the one thing we can say is that we likely want to take the matching point inside the belt, right? Okay. So we're looking at this, but I still want to fix my phase choice here. So what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to take phi r here, and then I'm going to take the entire set of points that I calculated for phi r, and I'm going to divide them by the value that my left solution has in the matching point. So that just meant that, well, I had to make up my mind. So my phase choice from the left side and the right side, I just went with the phase choice here from the left side, and I imposed that on the other one. So it so turns out that phi L here is negative, then it's going to change the sign of everything that we have obtained from the coming from the right side. Right. The other thing here is if I do something like this, then automatically phi r here in my matching point is equal to phi l into matching point. So, okay. You all cool with that?
You're saying that the new phi r becomes the at xm becomes the whole VR at XM over?
The entire. You know, I'm thinking about sort of a, so if you run a right in Fortran, it would be phi R here. Colon is equal to phi R, but colon here divided by phi elevator. I just rescaled, yeah.
Shouldn't the normalization factor be phi L of XM divided by phi R of XM instead of just one over phi L?
Phi R goes to phi prime divided by phi L over of XM. But there was something else.
Yeah, then why do we then need phi R at XM in order to obtain that?
Let's just get this straight. What I did is that I just multiplied the solution from the right by a constant.
Yeah.
Okay. In so doing, I might have changed the sign of everything I had there. But in doing so, I imposed my sign convention from the left side.
But we don't know that psi L XM is modulo 1.
Modulo 1?
Has magnitude 1, complex magnitude 1.
Yeah,
the problem is that your normalization factor is not right, actually. It does depend, it should depend on phi R of XM and phi L of XM.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're right, yeah. So I need to take the phi R here, XM separate. Is that better?
No, it would be in.
Right?
Phi L divided by phi L of XM divided by phi R of XM.
Yes, I think we're getting there now. Right? Happy? Okay. So I rigged this, and then the last thing I need to do is that we need to we need to then match the slopes. Right. And that's why we wanted to take one step beyond it. But perhaps before I want to say one more thing about this. If we need to do something like this, you could see that this would go wrong if the matching point here is an actual node of the solution we're looking for. So when you do this, we can see here that XM cannot be a node of the eigenfunction. And that's the reason why, quite often, we take the matching point to be this point here, which is called the classical turning point. So that's when the energy is precisely equal to V of X. We put the matching point there precisely for this reason, because we know out here I'm going to have a solution which is exponentially decreasing. So it'll be non-zero when I hit the wall of the well, and then it's going to be oscillating. And if you go up to the higher states, it might be oscillating quite rapidly in there. If I choose it at this point, I know that the wave function is likely non-zero there. In many cases, if you look at strange potentials, you maybe cannot make an obvious choice like this. But basically, in this case, where we have a nicely behaved well, we would typically put it there because I know that the wave function I'm looking for, it doesn't have a an actual zero, and it means that I can fix my phase choice and I can get everything to work out. So
What we need to do is that we need to match the slopes. So that's very, so the criterion that we usually look at here is we want to define a function simply of the init, right? It's a function of one variable, which is this one. So I want to point out that the entity that I have here is not yet an eigen entity. It's just some entity that we put in when we look for solutions. And what we would call the eigenvalues would be the values here of E that would hit correctly at the matching point, where we'd get the same slope and the same phase, right? So basically, what I need to do is something. I want to take the slope here when I'm coming from the left, and then I want to take the slope when I'm coming from the right. And then I want to divide here by 2h, but we also stick in a division here by phi r in the matching point. Okay, so these here, we can just look at the usual formulas. So we'll be looking at xm plus h here, and then minus phi l of xm minus h, and then minus phi r here in xm plus h, and then phi r in xm minus h. And this we divide by this one. Okay. So you know about bisection, and you know about, I wrote down the formulas for how we would be integrating phi l and phi right up to the matching point. Right? So we can look a little bit at what this would look like. So I could imagine that I'm coming from the left with something like this, and then I'm coming from the right with this solution here. So this would be phi L here. And so this would be our matching point xm. And maybe we have a here which is xm plus h. Maybe I have a point here which is xm minus h. And you can see in this case, the slope here, it is negative. But this slope here is even more negative. So I would claim that likely this is going to be an f of e, which is bigger than 0. If I go over to the other scenario where I have something like this, I have an xm, and then an xm plus h, and then an xm minus h. Then I would claim that this would be an FF, FE here, which would be less than 0. Okay? So the way it would work is one. You take some plotting program or a piece of paper, and then you plot it. Right? And I would start here with an E here,
that's below the bottom of the well. And then I would increase E. So what we're then hoping for is that if V here, it'll be nicely behaved, it's going to go through zero. Okay. And what you then would do is that you would visually inspect this little plot here, and you would determine A and B here. For your interval, and then here you would just run then by a section on f of e here on the interval a to b, and that would then find the solution. At the solution, I know that not only will the two wave functions agree, they will also have the same slope, and I have found an eigenvalue. So this zero here is the eigenvalue, and that would correspond to bound state. Okay. So what would the ground state look like in a potential world like this? Yes, roughly it's going to look like some sine, right? You can always approximate this by an infinite potential well, and it's just gonna. How many nodes will it have?
Sorry, no. Nodes?
No.
Zero.
Yes. How many nodes will the first inside state have?
One.
Okay. Second inside state?
23.
Two.
Three.
Well, two, hopefully. Might be. Yeah. We number them from. So, this is the famous problem in computer science, whether we start with n equal 1 or we start with n equal to 0, right? So. So, let me tell you in the last 2 seconds that I have already overrun. If you look at f of e, right, there was a little division here by the value of the wave function in the matching point. What do you think is going to happen to f of e here when you increase the energy from below here? And your solutions starts to develop a node. You have to get a node, otherwise you can't get to the next state. Yeah, and what, how's that going to show up?
Well, because we're dividing now a very small number by a very small number. A certain number.
Yeah. Well, so okay, I managed to locate the ground state. Then I keep increasing the energy, and the physics, if you like, means that my wave function will start to develop a node. At some point, that solution, which may not be yet an eigensolution because you haven't gone high up or increased the energy enough, it's actually going to go through and get a zero here at x of n. And then you will see that if you actually plot this, it's going to have
a very dramatic behavior, right? But that's kind of neat, because you know that if something dramatic here happens to f of e, then you develop a new node in the solution, right? And so if you plot f of e here, dividing by this factor, don't be obscured by the very strong features. It just means that the wave function developed another node. And there's some, I don't know if you've looked there or the homework assignment has been distributed yet, but there's some vague hints to what that might mean. But there's a lot of physics in that. It means that if you know the nodal structure of your wave function, and we do know that because we're working in it well here, then the weird behavior of your program, it can actually be explained in terms of physics. I do want to say that this is, I kind of like this problem because it's a computational physics force, and we have to solve the Schrödinger equation, and otherwise it wouldn't be computational physics. And there's a great satisfaction in getting this working, because you can just take out your quantum mechanics book and you can then modify this potential to anything you like. And it's actually something that sometimes I do for research, because you can reduce the problem that you're looking at to some potential well problem, and you can then take any potential well that you like and just boom, run it, and you find the offsets. There's no problem with this. I do want to say that if your program is not working, try to go back here and then plot f of e more precisely and try to bracket the interval here closer to the actual root. Particularly for the higher stage, you can see what's going to be going on here is that if we go up and look at the 16th bound state, it's going to have 16 nodes that are going to be going like crazy in here. And probably f of e here, if I go higher and higher in energy, it's going to start to look fairly weird. And we're going to have to be working rather hard. And of course, what you're asked to do is just to find the first few bound states here. Are there questions at this point? So you see, well, just integrate, match. When you match, you have a bound state.
But this would be done within Fortran as well, or do you take it out?
Well, the what I would, you know, this determine A of B here. No, just do it. Look at it. Right?
Okay.
So and by all means, don't attempt to write a program that would take a potential and then. An hour later, spit out all the bound states. that would be a lot of hard work. What you do is that you just trace out f of e, and then by hand inspect this, and then you can feed a of b to your little program that will just do bisection. And you already tried to bisection, and it works very well. And you have a function that you've determined, so it's positive here and negative there. Then you get one eigenvalue, and then you just repeat that if you want to get the second one. Yes?
No, I think that happens to be on the nodes.
Well, if it actually happens so that the actual solution does have a node here, then it won't work. So we have to avoid that, and that's why I said that for what we're doing, then we can take it to the side of the well here, what's called the classical turning point, because I know that the wave function, that or the actual bound states, they can't have a node there. You all cool with this?